Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. With Jeff Fawcett, PhD, we come to you weekly with a critical, independent voice on the politics and practice of health. We fear death, the dying part of it, and even the not knowing what happens afterward part that might be scary too. Would it surprise you that people who study death, like doctors, morticians, and researchers, don't know much about when death actually happens? Of course, that doesn't stop them from calling someone dead, since there are lots of things that happen after death and people are waiting to hear. Maybe we shouldn't be so hasty. Maybe all this should slow down quite a bit. Maybe people should wait. After all, historically, all cultures did wait quite a while to make sure someone was dead before they did more stuff to them, like harvesting organs. Oh yeah, if you're carrying a driver's license that says you're an organ donor, you either really need to hear what's coming or you should turn to some music now. Stay tuned for When Are You Dead? First, an editorial by Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett.
Thank you, Lena. I propose a simple test to find out whether someone is crazy. Ask, should nuclear power plants be used to generate electricity? If the answer is yes, even a qualified yes, then the person you're talking to, or working with, or voting for is insane. They need our help, of course, but we need to be protected to protect ourselves from their insanity. As Alexander Coburn wrote in The Nation, Japanese anti-nuclear activists are at the threshold of a remarkable event. He says, quote, at the moment, only 2 out of 54 reactors in Japan are operating. There have been no blackouts because of power shortage. If the anti-nuclear forces manage to stop the restart of the remaining reactors, which has to be locally approved in each prefecture, all reactors will be shut down by May. End quote. This could have profound implications elsewhere. The nuclear industry inside Japan is fighting back, and the nuclear industry worldwide is watching carefully. Why exactly should we be concerned about the use of nuclear reactors? I start with the conclusion of the National Academy of Science, an organization known to be friendly to the needs of government and progress, which means the advance of technology, which means the advance of industry. In 2005, after decades of foot-dragging, the Academy concluded that there is no known safe dose of ionizing radiation. To fans of nuclear energy, no known safe dose enables them to reassure us that the little itty-bitty doses we've received from Fukushima and are still receiving from Chernobyl and Three Mile Island and all currently operating nuclear power plants are nothing to be concerned about. I say that any sane person would know that no known safe dose means get rid of that stuff. I think we're all familiar with the dramatic health effects of radiation poisoning suffered by people in the immediate vicinity of a nuclear accident. On the other hand, I don't think most people are familiar with the less well-known effects of what are called low-dose, slow-dose exposures in ionizing radiation that's released by accidents and is a routine part of power plant operation. Most of what we know is based on research conducted in the aftermath of Chernobyl, exposures that are still with us. The principal conclusion from this research is that exposures in ionizing radiation are bimodal. That is, the effect of a low dose is not a simple fraction of a high dose. Instead, as the dose of ionizing radiation approaches zero, the effect does not, but instead gets proportionately greater. What are some of these greater than expected effects? DNA damage, that is, genotoxicity. Disruption or outright failure of DNA damage repair mechanisms, oxidative stress, increased physiological stress, suppression of the immune system, that is, greater susceptibility to infection and increased inflammation, hypersensitivity to new exposures to ionizing radiation, such as from diagnostic and therapeutic X-rays, susceptibility to leukemia and related diseases, which are cancers of the lymphatic system, which is part of the immune system, and neurological impairment. This last one is quite interesting. Researchers observed increased cases of poor attention, memory loss, mental exhaustion, reduced mental ability, and in 70% of cases, very high levels of anxiety. Quote, some patients could not even remember their phone numbers or what they had just read in a newspaper, end quote. The researchers emphasize that these conditions are not the result of stress, but of actual damage to the central nervous system. What sane person would want to put people at risk of such suffering? I mentioned the details of low-dose, slow-dose exposures to ionizing radiation because of an article in The Environmentalist by Cindy Sage, which draws a direct parallel between the effects of low-dose ionizing radiation and low-level exposures to non-ionizing radiation, that is, radiofrequency radiation from wireless technologies, such as cell phones, and extremely low-frequency radiation from sources such as electric power lines. The first parallel is that both ionizing and non-ionizing radiation are bimodal. The effects of low exposure are much greater than would be expected from the effects of high exposures. Again, as the dose approaches zero, the effect does not, but gets worse. The second parallel is the actual symptoms suffered, DNA and DNA repair damage, oxidative and physiological stress, suppressed immunity, hypersensitivity to subsequent radiation exposures, and damage to the central nervous system with a variety of debilitating conditions. And so I ask, with respect to both low-dose ionizing and non-ionizing radiation, what sane person would want to put themselves and other people, especially children, at risk of such suffering? In the final episode of a spy thriller I watched recently, the section chief asks a spy, "What's our situation?" He replies, "Bad people are trying to kill us." I'd say nice people, too, are trying to kill us because they are insane. A transcript of this editorial is available at yourownhealthandfitness.org. I'm Jeffrey Fawcett. Take care of yourself.
Jeff Fawcett is a political economist, writer, and health integrationist who produces this show with me and is primary author of our book, Too Much Medicine, Not Enough Health. And today we're joined by, we're calling the show When Are You Dead? And we're joined by the author of the newest book, The Undead, Organ Harvesting, The Ice Water Test, Beating Heart Cadavers, How Medicine is Blurring the Line Between Life and Death, Dick Teresi. Let me give you an introduction. Welcome to you, first of all.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. Dick Teresi is the author or co-author of several books about science and technology, most recently The God Particle and Lost Discoveries, The Ancient Roots of Modern Science, From the Babylonians to the Maya, both cited as notable books by the New York Times Book Review. He's co-founder of Omni Magazine and has written for the New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Smithsonian, The Atlantic Monthly, and Discover, among others. Teresi has been an editor at 8 national magazines and was editor-in-chief of 4 of them, Omni, Science Digest, Longevity, and VQ. I'm very pleased to have you on the show. I'm looking forward to this interview. I think we might want to start by having you talk about, because this is a fairly long book, so it isn't a single, it isn't just one, you don't have one message here exactly. You have an argument, but you have an enormous amount of information in this book, which is, you know, around 300 pages. So what did you set out to do when you wrote the book?
Well, I was inspired by Carl Sagan. I saw him on the Charlie Rose show one night. He looked awful. He looked like he was dying. And he said he had been saved by science. He'd had this wonderful transplant. That he wasn't going to die anymore. And my wife was watching it with me, and she had been in cancer support groups, and she said, "Oh, my God, he's going to die." Not only because of what he looked like, but because it was the rhetoric of people in her groups when they got their news that they were terminal, especially if they were like worked in a technical or scientific or medical field. They couldn't believe that was going to happen to them. And then the program ended, and sure enough, it was a repeat. He had actually taped the show a couple months before and had died in the meantime. And one of the things that struck me when he was talking, and this is one of the world's great skeptics about everything, is that he said he knew what death was and that it was a long, dreamless sleep, quoting Shakespeare. And I thought, well, that can't be. You know, sleep is nothing like death. You're breathing, your heart's beating, it's kind of pleasant. There are neurohormones being secreted. So I wonder, well, if he can be so mistaken, let me see if I can find out what death is. And that's what I set out to be. And I thought, I'll just start with a real simple question and then go on from there as to what science says about death. And what does it say about who's dead and who's alive? And I thought I would find wonderful deathometers or deathometers and gadgets and gizmos that would say, yep, dead, yep, not dead.
Yeah.
And what I found was nothing of the sort.
Not at all.
And what I found was that it's quite debatable who's dead and who's alive in the modern world, and that we've actually have gone backwards in deciding in our rush to call people dead for our own purposes.
How do you feel about me bringing up broadcasted interview with Terry Gross? Do you mind me bringing that up?
No, that's fine.
So I found your book wonderful, and I devoured it, and it meant I was up very late last night. I thought it was a marvelous book. I found it very nuanced and very complex, and it brought up just about everything you could think of when you think of what's the deal with death, including spiritual aspects of what people believe and the sort of famous line of, you know, we came from nothingness. We're going back to nothingness. Why are we so afraid? We came from that. Why, are we, you know, so all the nuances of it. And yet what happened, Terry Gross is somebody that I've greatly admired my whole career. And she did something that I consider a breach of her own rules, which is to not have an impact on someone's reputation. She interviewed you for 8 minutes about accusing you of frightening off people from becoming organ donors. And then she switched from the interview to the rest of the show was an interview with a surgeon who does, I will use the word harvest, although they didn't like that word, harvests organs for this, and reassured everybody in modulated tones that this was all just fine, that there's no pain, there's no this, there's no that. So I was distressed because your book is far more complicated than what she did. You in no way had it in your mind to discourage people from organ donation when you started doing this.
Well, there's nothing in the book that says anything about it one way or the other. I didn't encourage or discourage people.
True enough.
I could see where someone might be discouraged or might, in fact, take more precautions than the organ banks would like you to take.
Exactly so.
And I did in an article in the Wall Street Journal, I had something that was not in the book, and some steps you might take to safeguard yourself. And I think they didn't like that, and perhaps Terry Gross didn't like that. But it's interesting, her reaction, because the interview was an hour and a quarter, the real interview, that she taped with me. And it was far-reaching and went into my personal life, and which she took issue with, and certain beliefs that she took issue with. And the thing is, it didn't bother me because I have seen this throughout the entire process of researching this book. And, for example, I would speak to college classes. Professors would invite me to talk about death. And when I would talk about these topics, people would get very hostile. Students would get up and actually yell at me, and what's wrong with you? And, you know, they had like a grandmother who was in a persistent vegetative state, and they wanted to unplug her, and, you know, and it was costing them a fortune to keep her alive, and a lot of vitriol. And I wondered what I was doing wrong. And then I came upon an incredible study by a guy named Sheldon Solomon, who's at Skidmore, and two of his other researchers, who did something called mortality salience experiments. And what they did is they gave people a long psychological exam during which one of the hidden, it wasn't a hidden question, but they would ask them all sorts of questions. But the key question was this, was to say, try to think about yourself when you're dead. What will it be like? And, you know, write down your thoughts about being dead for about 5 minutes. And then they went on and they would give them essays, both pro-American and anti-American essay, and asked them to comment on it. And control groups were not given the instructions to think about their death. The groups that were told to think about their death had this sort of subliminal idea of their own mortality, and they came down very, very hard on anti-American essays. And on the pro-American essays, they were wildly enthusiastic. And he did these experiments over, these experiments have been done in countries all over the world by other people. It's been done 300 times, and they get the same results. And they've done it in different ways. Instead of having them think about their death, they flashed the word death subliminally on a computer screen. Or they conducted the interviews outside a funeral home, In one case, they asked the judges to set bail for prostitutes that had been arrested and in New Mexico. And the bail guidelines are very, very rigorous, and there's really only one answer that's true. And those who had been reminded of their death set a bail that was 9 times higher than the requirement.
So much.
But what they have concluded is that when people are reminded of their mortality, they circle the wagons, as it were, around their worldview, and they get fiercely defensive of it, and they attack anything that threatens it. And that's what was happening in these classes. And Solomon told me to try something that might help when I give a lecture, is to have people think about that, their death, and then drive it home to them, not make it subliminal, and tell them exactly what I was doing. And he said that, according to Freud, if you confront people with immortality, if you shake the skull in their face, there will be a window in which you can reach them, in which their fear will go away. And when I did that, these classes became very excited and were very interesting.
Yes.
I could not do that with Terry Gross because it was her show.
You can do it here.
Yeah. But, I mean, we got into such topics as, like, why didn't I go to my parents' funeral? And why don't I go to weddings? And why don't I do the things that a nice girl from Brooklyn would do,
Well, I'm a nice girl from Brooklyn, and I don't do either of those things either, so I can relate. Let me just let people know that you're listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. Jeff Fawcett is sitting by me, and we are talking on the phone to the very lively science writer, Dick Teresi. It's T-E-R-E-S-I. His newest book is The Undead, and it's quite a read. I think people might want to pick it up. So the interesting thing about hearing what you just said is that the Buddhists have, all forms of Buddhism have this idea that what you need to do is meditate on your death, so that you will open your heart, so that you feel that you're transitory, and you open your heart to compassion. But it is interesting that when people become afraid, they become hostile. So here we are with all of that. Now, one of the things that I picked up on immediately when the book landed on my desk is that there is a medicalization of death in this country, and that we have moved very far away from the ancient traditions of all cultures, where there was a waiting period before burial. There was respect and waiting, and there were issues. There was lots of ways of testing to see if someone was really there. So they really gave it a good long try. But now we have an economic interest, and we have bodies as commodities. And that's gotten us into a world of hurt. So would you like to touch on traditions around death and how they prevented the possibility of burying somebody before they were dead?
Well, you're absolutely right. It was a huge concern among people from the ancient Egyptians on forward, and probably before then, that you shouldn't bury people or cremate them before they're dead. And it was a real no-no. For example, doctors or embalmers who declared people dead in 2600 BC in ancient Egypt, if they made a mistake, they would be stoned. And this was true through, most of time. And all sorts of different methods were contrived to make sure that people were dead. And, the Egyptians, for example, were sort of like Woody Allen. The brain was their second favorite organ.
Well, the other thing that's like Woody Allen is the way everybody feels in this culture, which is that I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be there when it happens.
Right. And the Egyptians had no use for the brain. When they made the mummies, they just emptied it out because they just thought it was like garbage. And they propped up the genitals instead. So death has been mostly focused around the heart, but also breathing. And very, very early on, people discovered that cell death was the gold standard, which equates to putrefaction. When you were really smelling bad and your cells were decomposing, you were probably dead. But people had death watches and death vigils through history, and it was done by ordinary people. Doctors weren't there to declare death. Doctors were there to try to keep you from dying. And the Pope, as you probably know, has a Camerlengo, which is a special cardinal that the doctors may may diagnose that the Pope is dead, but he's not dead till the Cameron Lango says he's dead. And this is somebody who's, you know, handpicked by the Pope, someone he trusts, who hits him in the head 3 times with a silver hammer and calls out his baptismal name to make sure he's dead. And you can pretty much trust this guy because his duties end when the Pope is dead. So there's no reason for him to jump the gun because he's just, you know, declaring himself out of a job.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just remembered, you know, this. Is it, Jeffrey, is it The Meaning of Life, where they're the Monty Python, where they're going, it's the plague, and they're wheeling wheelbarrows and things through the streets, yelling, bring out your dad. Is that The Meaning
actually,
of Life?
Actually, I think it's...
Life of Brian?
No,
Meaning
it's
of Life.
Anyway,
it's Monty Python.
The Arthur myth.
Oh, okay. Anyway, so that's what
Holy
they're
Grail.
Doing. They're the Holy Grail. And so they're doing that, you know, bring out your dad, and they drag this guy out, and he's still alive, you know, and they're trying to, and he says, no, I'm okay. See, I feel much better, actually. I'm feeling much, no, you're not, you're dead. No, I feel.
Well, that's sort of something akin to that is happening today.
Yes.
Yeah, in the last couple centuries, there's been, as you say, the medicalization of death, where doctors have taken over. And
it's a big industry. I mean, I'm sorry to be so cynical. Well, no, I'm not sorry to be so cynical, but yes, it's wondrous that we can transplant organs and save the lives of children. I'm not minimalizing that, but in fact, the problem is that it's too much money. And people are making too much money off of this.
Well, I'm not a judge of what's too much, but they are making money, and
it's too much if they're not being ethical.
Right. Well, the thing that I saw across from, you know, 2600 BC till around 1968 is scientists and people kept putting up roadblocks to declaring death. In other words, they we can't do it yet because we've seen a case where that wasn't death, etc.
Well, and that is in fact true. I mean, that's true to this day now when they test. Sometimes they're all ready to sign the papers for the organ donation. The person suddenly coughs and sits up. So, I mean, this does happen after
right.
They've tested people to make sure they're not dead, and they revive.
Right. And in 1968, however, as we kept erecting barriers to declaring death, 1968, we took a huge step backwards, and we have now the lowest standard for death in history when the concept of brain death was formulated at Harvard by 13 guys. And that concept of brain death as legal death was finally codified in 1981 by the Uniform Determination of Death Act, which now says that brain death is legal in all 50 states. It also kept, you know, the cardiopulmonary standard. But the interesting thing is that there are no real standards given in that law for what you have to do. It just said, oh, let the doctors figure it out. And so it pretty much says you're dead when the doctor says you're dead. And there's no appeal. The act says that no doctor may be tried for murder, which is what the Harvard committee wanted. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be able to stop to declare people dead when they're brain dead, and they didn't want to have to go to jail for killing people when they took their organs out. And it also says that you can't sue a doctor for declaring death prematurely. So doctors in 1981 are not going to be stoned anymore as they were in ancient Egypt. You can't touch them. And the whole reason for this is that for organ transplants, you don't want the person to be really dead. You want them to be, you know, as the Princess Bride say, mostly dead, but not totally dead. You want the heart to keep beating. You want to put them on a ventilator. You want the blood flow to keep the organs fresh because it's very difficult to transplant organs from a person who has had a heart attack because there's no blood flow to the organs. They're not getting oxygen, et cetera. So they wanted someone who was, as one doctor put it, pretty dead. Not dead, pretty dead. And that's what they got. And that's what we're stuck with at the moment.
One of the things that's remarkable about this sort of mostly dead state is that you know, immediately when you think about the tests for what would be done, you think, oh well, you know, they're brain scanning people to find out how the brain works, so why wouldn't they slap a brain scan on a person who is in a persistent vegetative state to see if they're alive or not? But no, they don't do that. They do things like pour cold water in their ear, look at their eyes and stuff, and you know, even the ancient Greeks knew that there were conditions that mimic death, that weren't death, where people are kind of trapped in there.
Well, we're adding conditions to that list every day.
There are drug things and stuff, yeah.
The basic test for brain death is really looking at the brain stem, which is the stalk at the bottom of the brain. And the original what's called the Harvard criteria that came out of Harvard in 1968, there also weren't supposed to be reflexes, and now we allow reflexes. And we still say you're dead. You weren't supposed to move, and now we allow movement. You were supposed to get an EEG, and there were a couple of studies after that, because the text, as it were, these Harvard criteria, this paper that ran in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 68, was based on no patients. They didn't look at a single patient. It cited no scientific studies, none. It only had one citation, and that was to Pope Pius, who said, oh, let the doctors figure it out, and we should stay out of it. So after that, there were a couple major studies, one in 69 through 71, another one 71 to 74, where they actually looked at people, at patients who had been declared brain dead on the what they call the clinical side of the test, the ice water in the ears and
the eyes,
the Q-tip on the eyes, et cetera, but without an EEG. And they gave them EEGs, and when they did, they found that a number of them were still alive.
Oh, boy.
So they're thinking, well, we've got this great test that's easy, and the EEG messes it up because it keeps showing us that these people really have brain waves. And if they have brain waves, well, what's waving if they're brain dead? So they found a very neat solution was, let's not do it anymore. Let's not do the EEG anymore. And that's pretty much the way it is. In some hospitals, they're responsible, they're rigorous, they'll do EEGs, or they'll do blood flow studies to the brain.
And those
they're
seem
not required to.
Right, but the blood flow study looks like a real gold standard. That looks like a pretty good test. Isn't it a good test?
I don't know how good it is, it's very interesting because one doctor said, you want me to do that? That's cost $1,000. Now we're talking about organ transplant operations that they're getting $650,000 a piece for him, but they don't want to spring for the extra $1,000 for the donor to make sure he's alive. Mm-hmm. I find that somewhat disturbing.
Now, let me just say that I suspect that some people may be listening to this and thinking, well, you know, as you pointed out, somebody in their family very sadly fell into a persistent vegetative state or a long coma and it was elderly, and it did not look as though this person could recover. And they think, well, you know, in their wishes it says, don't revive me. Let me go if that happens and stuff. I'm not saying that people shouldn't respect the wishes of people who do not want to be kept alive in a vegetative state. I'm also not questioning the fact that it can be enormously expensive and very time-consuming to care for somebody, you know, even if you took them home and you had to, because the body continues to function in certain ways. You have this waste to clean up, there's stuff to do, they have to be fed in some way, on the odd hope that they may recover with some brain damage or something. The problem with all of this, the part that's disturbing, is, again, it's not the death, it's the being there when it happens. And the question of whether people who are in persistent, because you have numbers of cases in your book that we can discuss after the break that's coming up in a moment, where people have recovered, both young and old people have recovered and lived on to have more of a life, who said that they heard everything that was going on and felt trapped and couldn't get out. And when we come back from break, we can talk about that. That's what we're trying to prevent happening and why we're discussing this. So we're going to take a brief musical break. This is Lena Berman, Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm on the phone with Dick Teresi, T-E-R-E-S-I, his book, The Undead. We will return with more of this interview in just a moment. Please stay with us.
Of May. sit down beside me and hear my sad song. For my poor head is aching and my sad heart is breaking. I'm a poor cowboy and I know I done wrong.
Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. We are talking today with Dick Teresi, T-E-R-E-S-I, about his book, The Undead. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, for easier, extended access to our over 500 archive shows, the library card feature. There's information, just a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more at yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, or you can email us at admin, A-D-M-I-N, at yourownhealthandfitness.org. So we're talking about, and now there's a section in your book where you actually list some situations where anesthesiologists have observed that people are not dead as this thing starts. And that's the point where people should take pause.
Well, anesthesiologists have been at the forefront of lifting the veil on harvest, or as I think Dr. Freeman, who was interviewed by Terry Gross, called them, what's the new word? Donation procedures. That's a much nicer
Yeah, he
word.
Didn't like the harvesting
yeah.
word.
The other word they use is retrieval or recovery, which makes no sense. Retrieve means to find again. And, you know, like, I have my kidneys right there in the back of my tarsal.
Yes.
I think they're just where I want
yes,
them.
Yes. Oh, and another Monty Python thing comes to mind, and I don't remember which one this is, where someone shows up at the door of this guy and says, you've donated your liver, and we'd like it now. He says, but no, I'm using it, you see. No, we need it now. No, but I need it.
Well, there's the implication here that your kidneys shouldn't be there. They should be in some guy who is willing to pay, you know, $500,000 for
Well, or to really tug on people's heartstrings, there are children and young people who have a long life to live who are suffering. So you
and,
want...
And, yeah. and they're all orphans and African Americans who just happen to have an extra half
yeah,
million.
Yeah, just happen.
And I noticed the doctor also, Dr. Freeman, who is on the Fresh Air, said that what he's offering, you know, clearly they're offering donors nothing. They can't be paid. And we can see there are three groups in the transplant business. They're the recipients, and they get, you know, they get something. They get a benefit. The people in the middle are the technicians, the doctors and nurses and technicians, and they get something. They get $27 billion a year. That's what the industry is, spread over not that many people. And then the third group are the donors, and they get zip. And
their families, Green, their families don't get anything.
They
either.
Get zip, and is against the law, and conveniently against the law.
Yes.
And
come along, mother.
So Dr. Freeman says what he's offering. He actually uses this word. I have the transcript. He says I'm giving them immortality. I think he said.
Yes, he does, and he says it in that tone. He said the whole. I'm sorry to be. I'm really trashing their interview, but I was really. I have to say again. I have so much respect for Terry Gross. I mean, she's been one of my heroes, and I've heard her speak, and I use some of her values on this show. But I just feel that they did this book such a disservice, and it's also appears to me as though NPR has taken this turn that's very, very oppressive. Because the purpose of covering this information with you, and you are a journalist, by the way, so this is, well, I'm saying that you stand to the journalistic standards. You have notes and references in the back. You're reporting on these situations, and you give a very balanced and very well-written case. You make a case. So the problem, the reason I'm attracted to the show is that I am concerned about the medicalization of everything and the commodification of everything, and I am concerned about the value of human life, and I think people need to be educated so that they can make an informed decision. So I want to protect the innocents. And, you know, first of all, why are anesthesiologists catching these cases? Why is there an anesthesiologist in the room if the person is dead and can't feel anything?
Well, to answer that specific question, here I found the quote. He says, transplantation is life after death. But I've talked to organ wranglers, the people who go into the intensive care units and collar the families of people who are dying, which, by the way, is a federal law. The families have to put up with it.
And it's brutal in some
ways. They are the hospital. The law says nothing about the families, the next of kin. The law says the hospital must provide access to those families. It doesn't say anything about whether the families have to take it. But basically, these people appear, and they have a federal right protecting them to be there. And while your daughter is dying, they're yammering at you for the body. Which, by the way, if you at 3.3 organs on average per body, that body is worth to them more than $2 million. So the main argument Organ Wrangler told me that he uses it is that the sadder the family, the more of an in he has, because he's offering them quote-unquote meaning, M-E-A-N-I-N-G, meaning. And, you know, Dr. Freeman put it more blatantly, which is life after death. So it's a little bit like your televangelist. You have your life is miserable, you're going to die, or your loved one is going to die, but send me some money. You know?
Well, the other
and you'll have eternity.
The other thing that's shocking and distressing about this is the certainty. Anyone who is that certain, I find dangerous. How can you be certain about that? I mean, we're not certain about anything, and there have been many situations where we were wrong about whether or not we were inflicting pain, and you give many examples in the book. Not the least of which is the lobster in the boiling water screaming and hanging on to the pot. I mean, hello? But, I mean, there are all kinds of situations where we found out later that people were awake and in pain during procedures. I mean, there's all... So how can he say with certainty? And he says, he doesn't say, we believe so. He says, she says, well, are they, you know, will they feel... No, absolutely not. They're dead? No. So, you know, you've got some very shocking... examples of this in the book.
A number of cases, you know, this hit a peer-reviewed journal, Anesthesiology, about a 30-year-old patient starting to breathe as they were about to
gasping.
Take out his liver.
Yeah, gasping.
Yeah, he was gasping for air on his own, and the anesthesiologist said, you know, we got to stop. And the surgeon said, well, he's legally dead.
Oh.
We can proceed, and they took out his liver.
Oh. On the brighter side, there was the. Do you want to tell the story of the pregnant woman?
Well, this pregnant woman who had seizures after delivering her baby, and she was about to be harvested and had been declared dead when the anesthesiologist noticed that she had reactive pupils in her corneal reflexes and gag reflex.
She was moving her limbs too.
And then she gasped and she started moving her arms and legs, and she was released from the hospital.
And she survived.
It's interesting. Dr. Freeman is a transplant surgeon from Dartmouth Medical School, and but one of the smartest brain death advocates in the country is one of his colleagues, is James Bernat. But Bernat is not crazy. Bernat is says there are a number of episodes of people pronounced brain death and then finding out that they're alive. And his rationalization is that, it was just that the brain death exam was done incorrectly. If we do them incorrectly, this won't happen. But then I asked him, well, what percentage are done incorrectly? And he said, well, about 65%.
Oh, my God.
So 65% were done incorrectly. This is about 10 years ago. He says it's improved, but there are no new numbers.
Oh my
God. So he says, theoretically, there shouldn't be any mistakes. But practically, there certainly are. And... when they say it's your organ bank will send you a brochure that says this has never happened, and it's just not true.
Well, is it that's a very high statistic, the one you just said.
It's a bit much.
It's true. So is it the case that these cases of people, well, except, gosh, there's so much we don't know, but, you know, the documented cases of people, and you've talked about many of them in the book, there are other situations too we can talk about. Are these a really small percentage?
I would hope so, but you know, we don't know.
We don't know, do
well,
we?
Well, for example, one of the pro brain death advocates, I asked him, does he think that the organ donors are in pain when their organs are being harvested? And he sort of joked, well, no one's ever complained. Well, yeah, you wouldn't, would you?
But their heart rate goes up and their blood pressure goes up.
Their blood pressure goes up, their heart rate goes up, they sometimes move. But
when
the organ bank tells you brain death means you're legally dead and you're never coming back, for all practical purposes, they're right, because, you know, your liver is being shipped off here and
yes.
Your heart's being shipped off hither and yon. Of course you're not coming back when they do that to you.
God.
So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Another self-fulfilling prophecy is the test they do at the end of the brain death exam, which is called the apnea test, which is they disconnect the ventilator momentarily to see if you can gasp for breath on your own. And if you can't, you're toast. The problem with the apnea test is, one, it's usually done wrong. It's amazing that doctors don't know this, but you have to let the carbon dioxide build up, because the reason people gasp for breath is not because they need oxygen, though they do. It's because the excess of carbon dioxide in their blood is making them gasp. And sometimes the examining doctors don't let the carbon dioxide levels reach high enough. But the other problem with the apnea test is that it may be a self-fulfilling prophecy, in that it causes acidosis in the blood and also very low blood pressure. So if you are sick, and most people being tested for brain death are very sick, it's liable to drive you over the edge.
So the other problem that can happen is that you can be caught in between, you know, you can be sort of trapped in your body and you can't communicate. And there are a number of reasons why this can happen. Oh, I should also, let me just back up for a second. Sure. I know this makes my audience crazy when I do this. Candace Pert, who we interviewed ages ago, who was the person who discovered the opiate receptor in our body, very interesting scientist, she reminds us in the book, extrapolating from what she said, quote, just because one area in the brain is dead, just because the brain stem is dead, doesn't mean the cortex is dead. And it brings up the issue of whether or not the brain is running everything, since you can have a body that is, quote, unquote, brain dead, but the body is still catching colds, giving birth, sweating, eliminating, processing food. So the brain dead issue, it's questionable anyway. So let's go back now. Then there are people who, you know, this woman they didn't think, she thought she was brain dead. They, thank God, did a PET scan. And it showed that she was aware. So there's an issue of things like an accident can cause people to be blind or deaf, and they can't respond.
Well, there are these nether states, that I, as I call them, that are neither dead nor alive. And, they're definitely alive, but we don't know what to do with these people. Two of them are locked-in syndrome, and another one is persistent vegetative state. Now, Dr. Freeman's view was that you only have to test the brainstem, and the apnea test would prove perhaps that the brainstem was dead, and therefore if the brainstem is dead, the cortex is dead, the whole thinking, cognitive part of the brain where you live and where you feel pain and everything, that must be dead because the brainstem is more primitive, so the other parts will then be dead too. I don't know why this follows. And we can consider a zillion examples where it doesn't follow. There's a sort of top-down belief that the brain dies from the top of the head down to the brainstem, and all you have to look is bottom to see if it's dead. This would probably be true if you fell off a building and landed on top of your head. But as Candace is saying, there's no reason to believe that's true, and there's no reason to not believe that the brain is integrated. You cut off one part, another part takes over. So she said, the fact that the brainstem is down does not mean that you're not in pain. That doesn't happen in the brainstem. So this argument seems totally fallacious. And one example that is locked-in syndrome, if you saw the movie or read the book, The Diving Bell and the Butterfly.
Yes.
By Jean-Dominique Bobby.
Yeah, with Javier Bardem.
Yeah. There was a guy whose brainstem was damaged, but his cerebral cortex was fine. He wrote this beautiful book with one eyelid.
Mm-hmm.
Because typically in locked-in syndrome, that's all you can move. You can move one eyelid. And he was totally trapped because his brainstem was down. He was paralyzed, but except for that one eyelid. But he, outside of that, he was totally conscious, and he would often be treated as unconscious. And like, so shaving was a torture to him, because the guy who was shaving thought he wasn't feeling anything, and he felt everything. And he wrote this beautiful book, and people would refer to him as a vegetable. So there's a case where the brainstem was down, but the cortex was fine. And, you know, you ask yourself, like, how many people in locked-in syndrome have we sent to the organ harvest? I asked one U.S. doctor, I said, couldn't there be locked-in but without the eye blink, so we wouldn't know that the people were locked in? And he said, well, that's science fiction, because the disease is defined by having that eye blink. But that's meaningless, you know. We define it by, you know, the people who can tell us that they have it. If they can't tell us they have it, then they don't have it. And the opposite state is called persistent vegetative state, where the brainstem is still working, the people can breathe on their own. But it's believed, theoretically, that people in PVS, persistent vegetative state, have no working cerebral cortex, that they're unconscious. Although they have go through sleep and wake cycles, which is kind of annoying. I mean, you know, because the brainstem is kind of like an on-off switch. You're awake, you're not awake, etc. But it's sort of like the switch on a light bulb, and the theory in PVS is that the bulb is out, but the switch still works. And for like decades, we thought we had these tests that a guy named Fred Blum, who is Sonny von Bülow's doctor, came up with, which are bedside tests. You don't have to run any expensive imaging, and we can just tell by some simple tests that someone is in PVS. In the 90s, we found out that these were all wrong, and a London hospital found that using Plum's method, 43% of PVS patients are perfectly conscious, and some had been conscious for more than 4 years and being treated as if they were unconscious.
And
their
family,
who spent time with them, knew that there was awareness.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
saw every sign of awareness, but the doctors wouldn't believe them. And he said, you have to really be with these people all the time. And, of course, the PVS patients, when the doctor comes in, will freeze up. Because, you know, this is their enemy, and they freeze up.
Yes.
And so the doctor doesn't see any of these signs of consciousness.
Let me just remind people that this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm talking today on the phone with science writer Dick Teresi, T-E-R-E-S-I. His book is The Undead. So, you know, the one of the things that's interesting about the ancients' cultures is that it was one native culture where the way that they did the final test to make sure somebody wasn't just in some kind of netherland was to take them out and leave them under a tree in the woods and then go back in the morning and see. And, of course, animals know whether someone's dead. And in fact, sometimes dogs are used for testing this because they can.
Sepulchral dogs, I love the term.
They can feel it. They can sense it. They can smell it. So they will not be, forgive me, eaten if they're alive. And there's one case that you mentioned in the book where a young man put his sister out and came back the next morning. And she was sitting up blinking her eyes to get them to moisten again, and she was alive. So the important point here is that, you know, this is very difficult because if you have a loved one who has gone through this and you want to keep them around, it's not easy to do, and it will cost money to take care of them, and you will have to work on it. But it's a choice and a decision that people should be allowed to make. I'm not. I don't mean to minimalize this or moralize about this. Everyone has to make their own choice. But at the very least, anything that goes on from here should be done with the consideration that the person is likely to be conscious enough to feel all of this and should be treated with delicacy and respect, and possibly even, you know, it should be handled the way some of the other life-ending issues are handled, you know, where you're treated for comfort, as they would say, which means that your pain is treated. So, you know, it's very... Anyway, it isn't... You know, your book actually also discusses all kinds of other things, like near-death experiences. You have a whole very interesting section on it, and the fact that regardless of people's health or religion, the stories are remarkably similar. What do you make of that?
Well, let me just tell your audience that I'm not a believer, and I'm an agnostic. I'm not big into religion or God.
Not
or,
an atheist, huh?
No.
Okay.
That's,
you leave it open.
That requires too much arrogance, I think. No, a religion scholar told me that atheism is just the flip side of theism, and both people were being unreasonable.
So, I like that.
Well, you know the old joke about, you know, my parents were mixed religion. My dad was an atheist. My mom was an agnostic.
Uh-huh.
They fought all night long.
Uh-huh.
You know, there is no God. And mom says, there might be.
Uh-huh.
But the near-death experience to me is pretty much now accepted, not as a view of heaven, but at least that it's real and that it happens. In other words, people said, you know, I had this operation, I was clinically dead, and I saw this tunnel, and I saw relatives from the past, etc. Medical personnel are now believing them. This has happened in so many people, and as you say, across religion, religious beliefs. And the only thing left is to decide what is the interpretation of it? What does it mean? Does it mean that there's a heaven and these people saw it? Even people who study the NDE don't don't really believe that. They believe it's an amazing phenomenon, but they don't necessarily say it's heaven. They think it's too shallow to be heaven.
Yeah, I don't interpret it as heaven at all. I think it's just possible, though, because people really don't want to come back when they have it, because they have the sense of something large and something loving and something nurturing that they're going back to. So that I find reassuring.
But here's to me what the significance of the NDE is, that many of these people have had no blood flow to their brain when they've had the NDE.
Yeah, but why would it be the same symptom over and over? I mean, the same kind of, yeah.
Well, it's not always the same, but even if it is, the question is that if this is hallucination, which is the medical, basically accepted reason for these things, then our definitions of death are terribly, terribly flawed. Because if you're dead, what's hallucinating? If you've been judged dead by, you know, either a cardiopulmonary standard or by brain death standard, and then come back and you tell these all about this NDE, what exactly was hallucinating? Why are you having these visions when the blood flow has stopped to your brain? I think either then we have to accept that there's something very strange going on, or, in my opinion, nothing strange is going on except our definitions of death are terribly, terribly wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. So, what was it like for you to, I know you mentioned in the book, to research this book? It sounds like it was difficult, that it was a little bit traumatic to do this book.
Well, it was traumatic because, you know, I had these, reading about locked in and thinking about going to school harvest, still being conscious and trapped in my body. I would sometimes wake up and feel I was being suffocated, or that I was being considered dead, but I was still alive, and I was trying to talk but couldn't. That happened for a while, but then the more difficult period is actually thinking about death itself and the idea of not existing, the idea of just being plucked out of the universe, and that's extremely hard to comprehend. It's hard for me to comprehend. This sounds horribly arrogant. It's hard for me to comprehend a universe that I'm not in. Just as Nabokov said, he could not comprehend a universe that existed before his birth. He didn't believe that it really existed. And I think most of us believe that the universe will not exist after we go. We can't tolerate that. And Terry Gross couldn't tolerate it.
It doesn't bother me, actually. There are things that bother me about all this, but not that so much. It does make me really want to be very careful about writing my wishes. Are you still an organ donor?
No, I'm not. I was an editor at Good Housekeeping back in the 70s. I actually ran an article telling people how to become organ donors.
Mm-hmm.
But according to UNOS, the United Network of Organ Sharing, once you check that box on your driver's license, that's it. There are many...
Dr. Fawcett here made a phone call after I talked to him about your book, and he's got an appointment tomorrow to go in and have it reversed.
Oh, no, I know you can reverse it. What I'm saying is that your next of kin can't reverse it.
Whoa, that's very disturbing.
That's what I'm saying.
Yes, that's
and
very disturbing.
There's no... Despite what Dr. Freeman said, you know... I don't know where he gets off. He was saying that there's informed consent. I don't remember have that happening at the Department of Motor Vehicles. They just said, "Do you want to be an organ donor?" I said, "No." And they said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "No." And I don't remember them telling me that they were going to rehook the ventilator after I was declared dead, and uh-huh. that that my eyeballs would be taken out at the end, and that all my organs would be taken out, and I would be sewed up with Frankenstein stitches. And that my undertaker probably wouldn't get the body for a few days, because once they're through with you, they're through with you. So none of that was told to me. But once you check that box, now some hospitals and some organ banks will in fact still want the okay of the next of kin, but they're just being very careful. Technically, they don't really need it.
Well, and in fact, I think some people, when they mark that box, if they're really quite elderly, they won't harvest the organs, so they won't have immortality. Instead, they will be thrown on a slab, and they will be cut to pieces by medical students. I happen to take a cadaver dissection class, and it was very interesting because people said, oh, well, you know, they're not there anymore. It's not. And I had just the opposite experience. I mean, there was a table with these arms, you know, that had been cut off and part flayed, and there was a hand with skin on it. And I looked at the hand, and I thought, who did that hand touch and caress? You know, I felt very much the imprint on these bodies of their lives. My last question I wanted to ask is, we both talked about this concept of that people tend to die the way they lived, which, you know, makes me think I'm going to be talking too much and very, very frightened. I'm going to be frightened and talking too much, nervous and hyper-aroused as I go down. I wonder if we can change this. I wonder if there is a way to prepare. Do you have a sense of any of that after? Because you talked to a lot of very smart people when you did this book.
How to prepare for our death?
Well, how to prepare to maybe even live in a way that makes us a little better at the end, you know, makes it easier for us. I wonder what you think.
I don't know. I haven't seen any evidence of it.
Oh, dear.
I was a hospice volunteer for a couple of years, and people seem to keep their hang-ups to the very end.
That's too bad.
To the bitter end.
Yeah, that is too bad. I don't know. My own father, his last week of life, we visited him, and he kind of reverted back to an earlier state where he was less burdened and sweeter. Although at the very, very end, when he was in pain, it was rough, and then he gave him some morphine. And when I looked at the body, he looked very much at peace, and it looked like it was okay.
Well, as a hospice volunteer, I was told never to challenge a person's beliefs because, you know, their religious beliefs and other beliefs help them deal with death. And we had one patient who was in a terrible mood. He thought we had kidnapped him, and he was going to call him suicidal. And then one day came in, and he had changed, and he thought he was on a cruise.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very happy, and he said, these cabins are so much nicer than the last boat.
Oh.
And we thought, there's no real reason to tell him that he's not on a cruise.
Yes, let it go,
And so he died very happily.
That's good. We have to leave it there. I'm so thrilled with this interview. Thank you, Dick Teresi, much for this. It's Dick, T-E-R-E-S-I. The book is The Undead. Terrific book. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. Visit our website, yourownhealthandfitness.org, all spelled out, for easier extended access to our over 500 archive shows. You can also find out it's a free stream of this week's show, our book, and lots more, yourownhealthandfitness.org, or email us at admin@yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced by Lena Berman and Dr. Jeffrey Fawcett. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.